with the historical background of what we are doing. Now, with how many kingdoms are we concerned? Which are they? Judah and Israel. In reality, we are concerned with the third kingdom too. Syria. We've got to do with Syria. And you remember, Ben-Hadad, we've had something to do with him, and became seriously ill, and he sends Hazael to go to Elisha, and Elisha says to Hazael, he will live, he won't live, and that I see that you will be king, and you are going to do us a lot of harm. And Hazael says, I can do you harm, of course I can't do you any harm. So now we've got a position, if we just try and get it all in its perspective. We've been dealing a lot with the northern kingdom of Israel. If we go back a little bit to a dynasty, and it's been a long dynasty and a bad one, Omri was king of Israel. His son followed him, Ahab, and Jezebel. What a wretched pair they were, Ahab and Jezebel. When Ahab dies, his son succeeds him, that is Ahaziah, who doesn't live for very long, and his brother takes over from him, also the son of Ahaz. So you've got Jehoram, and that is where we are today. In the kingdom of Israel, we've got Jehoram, who is the son of Ahab and Jezebel, and the grandson of Omri. Couldn't wish for a worse life. Couldn't wish for a worse life. Leslie, you just sort of catch up on this, how the king of Israel. So now we've got Jehoram, the king of Israel, son of Ahab and Jezebel, grandson of Ahab. Let us go to the happier side. Yehuda. Now, normally speaking, Yehuda's had a good run. It's had some very good kings. Some of them haven't been so good, but it's been very good kings. We had a lot to do with Yehoshaphat, who reigned in Judah when Ahab and Jezebel reigned in Israel. Now, Jehoshaphat's son was also Jehoram. And here, it makes it easy on the one hand, it makes it more difficult on the other hand, that now we've got both in Israel and Yehuda, you've got two kings with exactly the same name. So on the one hand, it's a bit confusing. On the other hand, it's easier. You only have to know one name. So in the northern kingdom in Israel, you've got Jehoram, the son of Ahab and Jezebel. In Judah, you've got Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, which would have been very nice. There's only one thing wrong with Jehoram, and he married the sister of Ahab. He married the sister of Ahab. No, he married the daughter of Omri. But the sister of Ahab is married. So Yehoshaphat and Ahab are Mechutani. And Yehoram, Yehoshaphat's son's wife, is a daughter of Ahab and Jezebel. Not a very good combination. Not a very good combination. Jehoram's wife was the daughter of Ahab, the granddaughter of Omri. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. Yehoram's wife was the sister of Ahab, the daughter of Omri.
So she's not the daughter of
Deborah. No, I'm sorry. She was. No, she was the daughter of Omri, the sister of Ahab.
Ahab wasn't there, it would be Deborah that made
it. Well, a husband that allows his wife to make him bed is not a... I won't say anything more.
Yeah.
Isn't that so? And he fell in very readily with her. A little bit too readily. It suited his book very well. So it wasn't a good setup. Got it? Right. Now that is where we stand in the dynasties. Today we start, and as far as Syria is concerned, Ben-Hadad is dead, and Hazael has taken over. Now Hazael is a commoner who becomes a king. He's not descended from a king, he's a commoner who becomes a king. But so was Omri. The only thing is that it's been Omri, and it's been Ahab, and now it's Yehoram or Yoram. Sometimes he's called Yehoram, sometimes he's called Yoram. And we are ready to start in chapter 8 of the second book of Kings from verse 16. Yes. Chapter 8, verse 16. We finished when some time ago now, we finished that part of Syria where Ben-Hadad is dead and Hazael has taken over. So we've got Yoram is king of Judah. Yoram is king of Israel. Hazael is king of Syria. Not too difficult to that. So let us start from verse 16. Uvishnas Chomesh leYoram ben Ahab Melech Israel, Vihoshophot Melech Yehuda. And in the fifth year of Yoram, the son of Ahab, the king of Israel, and Yehoshaphat, the king of Judah, Molach Yehoram ben Yehoshaphat Melech Yehuda. There reigned Yehoram, the son of Yehoshaphat, the king of Judah. Here he calls the king of Israel, the son of Ahab, Yoram, and the king of Judah, the son of Yehoshaphat, Yehoram. But it's exactly the same name. Yeah, well, it's got a very big meaning. It makes it more the name of Hashem in it, and of course the credit is given to the son of Yehoshaphat that Hashem comes into his name rather than to the son of Ahab. And now on to the next verse, 17. Ben Shloshim Ushtain Shono Hoyo Gemolcho. Yehoram, the son of Yehoshaphat, when he began to rule in Judah, was 32 years old. Ushmone Shono Molach Yim Sholoim. And he reigned in the Ushmone Shonim, and he reigned in Judah for 8 years. And now he tells us, Vayelech b'derech malchei Yisrael, and this king of Judah went in the way of the kings of Israel. Now this is the first time that has happened. So until now, Judah has been a challenge to the kings of Israel. They have had to contend with Judah. Now, you've got the king of Judah, he decides to follow the kings of Israel. And it gives the reason. Ki ka'ashir osu beis ocho. And this king, Yoram, the son of Yehoshaphat, goes in the way of the kings of Israel. Ka'asher also based Ochob, as the house of Ochob did. Why? Ki bas ha questo beneficio, because his wife was the daughter of Ahab. Now, Jared's got the daughter of Ahab, and a little bit later, it's got the granddaughter of Omri. So we just have to deal with this as it comes. So let us take it that Yehoram married the daughter of Ahab. So if Yehoram married the daughter of Ahab, that means Yehoshaphat and Ahab were mechutanim, and this was the daughter of Ahab, and so she was the daughter of Izebel too. Vayas hora b'enei Hashem, and he did evil in the eyes of Hashem. Velo ovo Hashem lahashchis es Yehudo leman David avdo, kasher omar lo doses lehir ulebono kol hayom. And Hashem did not want to destroy Judah for the sake of David his servant, as he had said to him, that he would preserve the kingdom for his children for all days. And of course, that is the great thing of the house of David, that the house of David persisted until the destruction of the second base of Hikdosh, until the destruction of the first base of Hikdosh, I'm sorry, until the destruction of the first base of Hikdosh. But we know that when Moshiach comes, Moshiach will be a descendant from the house of David, and the line will be taken up again, which means that the line is still there. Now, I just want to point out to you, apropos of that, when we are speaking about the line of David HaMelech, we know that it goes quite long afterwards, because right through, after the destruction of the second base of Mikdash, which was 500 years, more than 500 years after the destruction of the first base of Mikdash, 500 years after the destruction of the second base of Mikdash, we still find the house of David ruling over Israel in spite of the occupation of the Romans. And you've got Rabbi Yehuda HaNossi, a descendant of David. Rabbi Gamliel, a descendant of David. So it still goes down. Even after all that time, we still have the rule of the house of David, although it is not in the form of a king. And so we know for quite a long time where it has gone. Today, we don't know who is a descendant of David and who is not a descendant of David. But of course, we know that there are many descendants of David HaMelech. I can just give you one clue. If anybody claims to be a descendant of David, you know he is not. So there you can really know, then you know that he isn't a descendant. Because anybody who is really a descendant of David and knows that he's a descendant of David will keep quiet about it.
So some people
might know that? There may be. There may be people, but they never say anything. They'll just keep quiet about it.
They have some of their children to know
that? Possibly. But they'd only pass it over to a child who they feel is worthy to know, otherwise they wouldn't do it. Your father said, if there is anybody, if anybody feels he's a descendant of David, then you don't have to worry about him. Mm-hmm. Yes, Karen?
During those 8 years, what did he do?
Who?
King of Judah.
He did naughty things, but not those wicked things. Well, some of it is written in Deuteronomy. I mean, the worst things is... What's that place called near me? San Francisco. Yes. Now, I take a place like San Francisco. You know what goes on there? Oh, it's such perversion. Well, you know.
Yeah,
I have to stop my actual. Here at least you've got the Kalil, you've got the Yula, you've got a few pockets all wherever you go. You've got a few pockets, you see. But there it's... you know, if people aren't honest in business, but the stuff that is done, I suppose it's done here also, but not to the extent that it goes on there. There it's the cult, it's a whole cult, and it's a whole force, and it's a whole political movement. It's unbelievable. Quite unbelievable. Now, these are things that used to go on in the Northern Kingdom, and now the Southern Kingdom has fallen for that sort of thing. During the reign of Gauron itself was that sort of thing. Not only that, look what Achot did. If he wanted anything, and he couldn't get it by fair means, he chose foul means. So if he wanted a vineyard, and the only way he could get a vineyard was he got it through inheritance. He killed the man who owned the vineyard, he killed his sons, and so he had to go back until it came to him. Because he was an act, then he would have been, then he inherited it. That is the way he did it. Now that sort of thing was going on. And the worst thing is when one does it, but when one does it and one justifies it, it's right. And one bribes the judges, and one bribes the witnesses, and it's a false case, it's a false judge, it's a false witness. And after that, the next step is that, but this is perfectly in order. We've got to do it. This is quite right. That is where the danger comes. And that is to what it came. Why did it come to that? It tells us Yoram's wife was the daughter of Ahab. And if she was the daughter of Ahab, what could you expect? I would like to go a little bit further with you because there is a sequel to it all, and the sequel, I want to take the sequel in order to join it together with some of the points that we are going to make. Now, Hashem didn't want to destroy Judah because of Dovid. He made a promise to Dovid. Seems really strange for Hashem to make a promise to Dovid, and if the children are bad and the descendants are bad, what's the good of the promise? So why should it be any worse? Now Yoram comes and does such bad things that Hashem said, I won't destroy that kingship. Still going to go on. Ve'yomov, in the days of Yoram, Posha Edom mitachas Yad Yehuda. Edom rebelled from under the hand of Judah. And that we find that whenever there was a weakening in the spirituality of Judah, immediately the nations round about began to attack. We find it in the days of Shmuel, after Shmuel's death, in the days of Shaul. As soon as Shaul goes away from the ways of Hashem, then the Philistines start attacking, or ready to attack him. And now the Edomites are ready to attack him. Vayabo Yoram Tzohiro, and Yoram goes across to Tzohiro, and he preempts the attack of the Edomites. V'cholo rechev imo, and all the chariots with him. I've explained to you that chariots in those days are what tanks were in the last World War, is right up to the present day. Vayehihu kom lailo, and he got up in the night by Yake es Edom, and he smote Edom, Hasilbeid Elov, that were round about him, Ba'esore Horekev, and the masters or the captains of the chariots. By Yomus Omla Oelov, and the people fled to their tents, that is, the people fled, he says, that is, the people of Judah fled to their tents. So what he did was, he attacked them in the middle of the night, smote those, the near ones, didn't go deep in because he was afraid. He smote in the middle of the night, he was afraid to do it in the daytime. Only those that were round about, he didn't go too far in because he was afraid. And when he had smitten them, he didn't finish the work, but as soon as it became light, he fled, and all these people fled back to their homes, back to their tents. So there was great fear. He wasn't at all certain of himself, great insecurity. By Isha Edom Mitachas Yad Yehudo Ada Yomazeh. And Edom rebelled from under the hand of Judah until this day. That means until the time that Hilda Yomi is writing this, which is quite a long time afterwards, and they were never able to subdue Edom again. Judah was never able to subdue Edom again. And these people were a thorn in their sides. They were on their boundary. The Yesidivre Yoram of Chol Asher Oso and all the rest of the acts of Yoram and everything that he did. Alohem Kesuvim al Sefer Divrei HaYomim Malchei Yehudo. Are they not written in the books of the chronicles of the kings of Judah? Vahishkat Yoram Imavuso, and Yoram slept with his fathers. Vahikobed Imavuso Vihil David. He was buried with his fathers in the city of David. Vahimloch Achaz Yohu Benel Tachto. And Ahaz, his son, reigns after him. At a short reign of 8 years. And now Ahaz, his son, reigns after him. Ahaz is the grandson of Ahab. He is from his mother's side. Anyway. Bishnash Teines Reishona Le'yero Ben Achav Melech Yisrael. In the 12th year of Yoram, the son of Achav, the king of Israel, Molech Achaz Yohu Ben Yoram Melech Yehuda. Achaz Yohu, the son of Yehoram, the king of Judah, began to reign. Here also it calls Yoram the son of Achav, whereas the son of Yehoshaphat is called Yehoram. Now, Ahaz, the son of Yehoram, is now ruling over Israel. But he is very... Ben Esrim Ushtaim Shona Ach.
I just kept thinking, I was surprised
the Hebrews still in... That is in Yehoram, the son of Judah.
No, but is he still retained? That's sometimes right. They take it
away. Well, descendant of David. Ben Esrim Ushtaim Shona Ahaz Yehoram. Ahazio was 22 years old when he started reigning. The thing is, how long did he reign? The Shono Achaz Molach Birushalayim. And he reigned for 1 year in Jerusalem. For 1 year. And now the Shem Imo Asalyohu. And the name of his mother was Asalya. Vas Omri Melech Israel, the daughter of Omri, the king of Israel. Now, if she was the daughter of Omri, she must have been the sister of Achav, and we are told that it was the daughter of Achav. But then we must say that it uses the word the daughter of Omri in a descendant of Omri, it was the granddaughter of Omri.
His daughter used also to stress the fact how much she was like Achav.
Well, we're coming to that, how much the son is like the father, the daughter like the mother, the children like the parents. And let us take it like that. So that is where we are. And of course, Atalia, as the queen mother, does a tremendous amount of mischief. It tells us, so the author, the Yidmiyor, tells us immediately that what was so bad about Yoram was what Yoram, the son of Yehoshaphat, is that he married the sister of Achav, and consequently he did all evil in the eyes of Hashem, and he followed the kings of he followed the kings of Israel. And of course, we know that the wife has a tremendous influence over the man. And if she's a very strong person, the man is not such a strong person. Not only has she got influence over him, she's also got power over him. And once the wife has got power over the husband, it is, to say the least, an unhealthy situation. Shouldn't be like that at all. On this whole question of how much one inherits, how much doesn't one inherit, what is environment, what is hereditary, it's all very intricate. Because it is complex, it's compound, and it's complex. It isn't simple. It isn't only that a person inherits the traits of his parents. Because it goes back to grandparents and to great-grandparents. It's not only that a child is affected by hereditary factors. There is environmental factors. What is what the environment means to a person? How much a person is affected by the environment? Tremendous amount. So it's all very complex. And in order to give you an idea of it, I want to read to you a certain passage from Rashi's, and a part that is very well known to you, to have some idea of all the difficulties that we have there, and it's, one can see how it works. You remember when the two angels came to Lot and they told him that he must flee from his, from stone and earth, because Hashem is going to destroy stone and earth. Now I want to read to you this passage and explain it to you, because there are principles involved here, and we are going to use these principles in order to handle certain situations. Well, Chumash tells us that the one angel, one of the two Malachim, said to Lot, Himolek al nafshecho, flee for your life. Don't look behind you. And don't remain in all this circle. Escape for Horo Himolek. Escape to the mountains. To the mountains country. Lest you should be consumed together with the people of Sodom and Gomorrah. Vayomer Lot aleihem, and Lot said to them, Alno Adonai. No, please not my masters. Don't ask me to be there. Hine lo motzo abdu chochem beidecho. Now that your servant has found grace in your sight, says Lot to these two, Vati dalchastecho asher osiso imovi lachayusis nafshi, and you have magnified your kindness which you have done to me to preserve my life. And it's not quite clear whether he's speaking to the angels or he's speaking to Hashem. I'm not able to flee to the mountains. Now, can you imagine something like that? An atom drop bomb is going to be dropped. And he knows what it is, because one has already been dropped on Hiroshima, and another has been dropped in Nagasaki. So he knows what it is. Atom bomb is going to be dropped, and he's told, and he knows this has to happen. It's Hashem's word in no uncertain term. It's going to drop. And Hashem says, get away to the Rockies. And he says, please, not to the Rockies. Too far. Can you understand an argument like that? Furthermore, he says, if I fly to the Rockies, perhaps the evil will attach itself to me and I will die. What evil will attach itself to me? He's flying to the mountains to get away from the evil. What evil will attach him? He don't know what it is. I want you to be clear of the difficulties. Here is a city that is near Baki. Nobody went to Berkeley the other day. No. Yeah, near city. Berkeley. Vehi Mitzor, immortal no shomo. Its name is Mitzor. Let me flee there. Hello, Mitzor. Is it not Mitzor? You've just said it's Mitzor. So what are you saying now? Isn't it Mitzor? And there I can live. But the logic is the reverse. He's got much more chance of living if he flees far away to the mountain than he is if he flees to Hitzor, which is close by. So what's the logic of it all? It's just, it doesn't make sense. By Yomir Eloban, he said to him, I'm prepared to grant you also this. It's really Hashem that's speaking to him. That city I will not destroy. Go there. So it means there was even a chance that Hashem would destroy that city too. He said, all right, I'll allow you to go to Mitzor. And then that is where he escapes to. And then he says, Hashem is Yotu ala Oretz, the sun shone over all the earth, the low water, Aaron, not for came to say. Now let us go over that and I'll explain to you how the Torah Balfe explains it to you. He's told that Sodom and Gomorrah is about to be destroyed, and Kohoro Himole, Pentisophe. Escape to the mountains, lest you be consumed. Bayomir lent alehem, not to the mountains. Abram is in the mountains. Avram is in the mountains. He says, he may no more of the chemechrech, but idalach is vajerosito ibodi. I found grace in your eyes and you've done me so much kindness. Lachayos is nafshi, to spare my life. I'm not going to be consumed in Sodom and Gomorrah. But olochi lo yuchali mole, or I can't escape to the mountains. Penti bokeini horo b'mati, lest the evil will cleave to me and I will die. Whose evil? His own evil. He is good, but he's been a little bit naughty too. He says, my own evil will cling to me and I will die. Why? No. The contrast. In Sodom and Gomorrah he's a tzaddik. When he goes to Avraham, he's no longer the tzaddik. So in contrast, he's going to be judged in by contrast. This is a belief. He says, I won't be able to say, I'll die.
Death will judge by contrast?
One of the ways. one of the ways. I know what you're thinking. I'm not going to move out of Los Angeles. Perhaps I should go to San Francisco. Don't risk it. It's so contagious. It's so contagious. And there is no inoculation. There is no vaccine.
You could go to San Jose.
There is just a bit of immunology that we have about it. But that's all. We've got a bit of immunology. Very good. That's not worthwhile risking it, you see. Now, that is what he says. I'll give you another example of it in a moment. He doesn't want to go. He goes there. Now he says, therefore, let me go. So Hashem, he says here, there is the city that is nearer to flee to there. Now here he means nearer, not in place, but in time. It's nearer in time. It's younger than Sodom and Amor. These cities came into being after the Tower of Babel. Sodom and Amor were 52 years old. This city was 51 years old. Now, Hashem is long-suffering. Erech Apayim. One of the midos of Hashem is Erech Apayim, his long suffering. What's that about it? So Hashem is Erech Apayim, Hashem is long suffering. There is an expression that Hashem doesn't destroy Ad Meleo Hasor until it is full. The measure is full. The measure is full with wrongdoing and evil, with transgressions, with sin. When the measure is full, then Hashem destroys. Until then, he won't destroy. There's still a chance. There are so many factors. There are so many factors in a person's life. And I'll explain to you how many factors there are in a person's life. We can't even count them. There are so many factors in a person's life. One can never know. So Hashem doesn't destroy. One can never know what kind of a son he can have. One can never know what kind of a granddaughter he can have. And Hashem waits. And waits, gives a chance. It is only when a certain point is reached that Hashem says, right, now is the time for destruction. So that is Ad Malay or Hasor. Hashem destroys only when the soul all is full. Soul all is a measure. Soul all is a measure. Only when the soul is full. So Avraham says that place is only, it's a year younger. Lot, I'm sorry. He says it's a year younger. So this, it fits in beautifully to the words. So this is the Torah Shebaalpeh. He says, Hinei no ho irazos. Hinei no. No's got two meanings. The one meaning is, Hinei no. Behold now, no is also 51. Hinei ho irazos krovel on it all. This city is near, it is only 51. Sodom and Amora of 52. The he mitzor, and it is mitzor. Mitzor is the same word as tzor. It's young. Tzor, it's young. The he mitzor. Immorto no shomo, let me escape there. So it's called mitzor because it was the youngest of the cities. Sodom and Amora was older, so this was called mitzor, it was the younger. Let me escape the Halo Mitzori. Is it not indeed younger? It's called Mitzvot. And he says, and is it not indeed younger? So, Usachi Nafshi, and my soul can live, and I am able to live there. Got it? So that is the way it works. And then it says, and Hashem destroyed. Now, we had another case very similar to this. So I've introduced you now to two principles. The one principle is that being in a good environment has a great advantage. We are influenced by our good environment. It also has a danger in it. What happens if we are not influenced sufficiently by our environment? Then we are judged more harshly if we were living in a bad environment, because there's the contrast. Why aren't you living like that? That person's also living in the same environment. And you can learn from him. So there, the midas hadin, the attribute of justice, is far stronger. Is that clear? Now we've got another beautiful example of that, which we have done before, and if you will permit me, I shall refresh your memories on it. You remember in the great years of drought with Eliyahu in Ahav's reign. Great years of drought, you remember when the walls of Jericho were rebuilt and Ahav came to comfort the person who had lost his sons. Ahav and Eliyahu came. And this man says, yes, this is the punishment for having rebuilt the walls of the... And Ahav says, nonsense, you think it doesn't happen that... This is life, this is nature, this happens. And Elisha says, in that case, Eliyahu says there won't be any rain. And there's no rain, and it's really bad. And now the water has dried up, the brook of Kris has dried up, and Hashem says to Eliyahu, arise, go to Tzorpah, which is by Tzido, and live there. I have commanded a widow there to sustain you, to feed you. And he gets up and he goes to Tzorpah and he comes to the entrance of the city, and there he sees a widow collecting wood, and thinks it might be, that might be the widow. By Yomer Eliyahu, you want to follow it in the first book of Kings, chapter 17. First book of Kings, chapter 17, verse 10. By he crowed Eliyahu, middle of verse 10, and he called to her. Eliyahu calls to the woman by Yomer, and he says, "Kichino lima at mine bakli veeshte. Bring me a little water in a vessel that I may drink. Please bring me." I'm sorry, he didn't say bring me. Kichino li. Please bring me a little water. And she went to take it, and he called after her and he said, "Likino, li pasvecher biyodeich. Please also bring me a piece of bread in your hand." He asked for bread, but tell me, "Chai Hashem lekecho im yeshli moel ki im lechap kemar pakad." He said, "All I've got here, what can I give you? All I've got is a little bit of flour in a pitcher, umat shemen betzapochas, and a little bit of oil in a crucible, and I'm only collecting two sticks. How much fire do I need to bake a little piece of bread from this small amount of flour and oil that I have?" There isn't even sufficient to sustain us. My son and I will eat it, and then we both lay down and we die. There's nothing more there. Vayomer Eliyahu Eliyahu, and Eliyahu says to me, "Al tiri, fear not, bo yasi ki voreich, do according to your word. You want to bake it, go and bake it. Ach asuli mishom uk katana vorishono. First make me a small morsel first, concisely and bring it out to me. And afterwards you will make for you and your son. And then there are a couple of lines of poetry. For thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, the pitcher of flour will never be finished, and the crucible of oil will never be wanting until the day that Hashem gives rain upon the land. And then it says, and she went and she did what Eliyahu had said, and he and she ate in the house quite a long time that he made, and true to his word, the pitcher was never empty, and the crucible of oil was never wanting, as Hashem had spoken. He became so ill that there was no life left in him. Now comes the crucial part. And she goes to Eliyahu and she says, "My lieber Loch is your Eliyahu. What have I to do with you, O man of God? Boso Eli, you came to me. Lahazkir es avoni, to bring to the surface my sin, ulahomish es avoni, and to put to death my son. As long as you were not here, I was a righteous woman. Now that you come here, there is the contrast. This must be the reason for my son's being on the point of death." She knows there must be a reason for it. She says, "This must be the reason. Here you are, it would have been better if you had not come to me. You've come to me and this is what you've caused." Is that clear? And then of course, Eliyahu says, "Give me your son," and he took her, and he called to Hashem and he said, Hashem Elokoi, in verse 20, "Hagam alo armona asher ani misgeldi ilmo, hareus elohomis esfodo," he says, You take it out of the woman. I've come to be with her. So you take it out of her. If she would have come to be with me, then you could have judged by contrast. But I came to her for her protection. And you judge her by contrast. That is his plea to Hashem. He says, this isn't right. I come to her. I'm benefiting from her. And you judge her by mine. How's that? Had she come to me, it would have been a different look. So there you've got the principle.
So you're saying that Hashem was punishing her?
It's not a question of punishing. You see, the attribute of justice takes its course. And you've got to bring into play the attribute of mercy. Of course, we prefer it if the attribute of justice can take its course, and it's not necessary to bring in the attribute of mercy. If I've got a job with an employer, and the employer goes through my worksheet, and he decides to dismiss me, I'm not bringing in enough. He'll be better without me. You must get a person to revert after. I'm only bringing in $5,000 a month. And my salary is $3,000 a month. He's left only with $2,000 a month. It's not good enough. He must get somebody to bring in $20,000 a month. This isn't good enough. He's going to dismiss me. He dismisses me and says, "You know, I've got a wife and I've got children and I've got payments to do. You know what you're doing to me. I'll try and work better. I'm still not going to bring you up to $20,000 a month." And he says, "All right. So, what has happened now? Do I deserve to be carried on or don't I deserve to be carried on? To carry on. I don't deserve. So why is he carrying on? Mercy. He's got pity. Now which would I prefer? Of course I preferred it with my own merits, and I didn't have to come to pity. That is, we would far prefer it if the midas hadin, if the attribute of justice can work, and we don't have to come unto pity. We don't need mercy. Can't do it that way. You can't do it that way. So when you are in the environment of a righteous person or a righteous society, of course the midas hadin is the attribute of justice is be like them. Then starts, you know, there's this excuse and that excuse and that excuse. So that is mercy already, it's not justice. But as far as justice is concerned, that is the way it works. Now, a great person, the greater the person, the more he wants justice. You remember the story I told you about Nachum Ish Gamzu, where, because he didn't run to the succor of the man who was hungry, and eventually the man died, he says, he goes through all that suffering, and his students, his disciples say to him, "Woe unto us that we see you like this." He said, "No, this is what I wanted. I asked for it. Woe would have been to you had you not seen me like this. I want justice. I want deen. I don't want rahmin. I can take it." Lot didn't want mercy. He could take it. He said, "If I go to Avraham Avinu, so it will be mercy that will save me. I don't want mercy. I want deen. I want my own merits. My own merits is there." So, that applies to each one of us. We are living in a society which is not ideal for making us more righteous than we are. Just no question about it. No question about it. And if we attach ourselves to people who are better than we are, and there is the question of contrast, we don't have to be afraid of it. We don't have to be afraid that Hashem will judge us by contrast, because we are so small that Hashem deals with us through mercy ab initio from the very start. Of course we are dealt with by mercy. And when we are dealt with mercifully, well, you know, but what we are expected to do is to take something. We are expected to take something from, if we are in a good environment, and for that something that we take, we receive a tremendous amount of credit. But that is the way it works, in the raw. Is that clear? Now, are there any questions you want to ask me about that? So those are two principles, that you must learn.
Before we go on, yes. The passage that you read is in chapter 17. Are you giving us the remnants of the Vexilis
shot? No, well, this is very, very, very little beyond the pshat. That is very little beyond the pshat. So this is still in order to get the workings of it. But what I want you to know are the principles involved. First of all, the principle of Meleo HaSofo. The measure is full. And then Hashem says, the measure of Sodom and Amora was full. Hashem comes and says, they've got to be destroyed. The measure of the world was full. So Hashem comes and there is the flood. But it took 10 generations. And then it came, it reaches a point where Hashem says, there can't very well be a return. Then there is. The second point that I made was that there is the question of being judged by contrast. And I explained to you how it works with Lot, and I explained to you how it worked with the widow and Amy York. How does it work with us? We must know that on the one hand, we cannot afford to be in a completely perverse society. We can't afford that. because we are bound to be affected by it. So we must do everything within our power to raise ourselves into a situation where we can find ourselves in a society where we are able to live. People, we are with people, we are with friends, we are with confederates who think the same as we do, and one helps the other, and one is able to go forward, one is able to make progress. That is the ideal. We don't have to be afraid of being judged by contrast. Also, Hashem judges us with mercy. We are not on that level. So Hashem judges us by the attribute of mercy. So by our being in a situation of a good society, a congenial society from the Torah point of view, we are only gaining and we are not losing. So that as far as we are concerned, we know exactly where we stand. So those are two important principles that it is good to know. But it is very good that if we are in a good environment, we know that there is upon an obligation upon us to emulate the environment which we find ourselves in, the people which we find ourselves, and reciprocally to contribute to that environment and make it go forward too. That is the second principle that I discussed with you. Now, we come on to another principle. Yes.
When Hashem asks Lot to go up to the mountains, is he also saying, raise yourself spiritually?
Of course, yes, you go up there. You've got Avrom. I'm not destroying you. You go to Avrom. To Avrom, he's scared to go to Avrom. He goes to Avrom, he's got to live along those of that. And don't forget, he doesn't know now that his wife won't survive. He thinks his wife will survive too, and his wife is certainly not up to his standard. But he has never dropped to her standards. He never dropped to her standards. As Akov did, as Yoram did, when the two men came to visit him, his wife and his daughters weren't home. They were in Beverly Hills. What does he do? He takes them and he gives all the hospitality that Avrom and Sarah and Ishmael did in his home. Lot does it all on his own. But he gives them all that hospitality. Not only that, when the people of Sodom and Amorah want to take these people out, because they are same as the people in wants these two men. He said, under their account, you can have my daughters. You can have my daughters. That's at least natural. But not these men. And they were about to kill him. And then they were smitten with blindness. But he stands in front of them. That is what he's prepared to do. Prepared to do all that just to save them. So he's got a tremendous amount in him. His wife wouldn't have done that. She didn't like this at all. You want to entertain, do it yourself. You want to be hospitable, do it yourself. And he thinks his wife is at this stage, he doesn't know that his wife was accompanying him. So to be with our Romans and Sarah, it's going to be very, very difficult. He's afraid of it. And one can understand why he should be afraid of it. So that we've got that part here. All right, Ross? Now let's go further. Now we come on to another principle. And that is the principle of Zechus Ovos. Zechus Ovos, usually, it's translated the merits of the fathers, ancestral merit. It's usually understood as follows. What's it understood? That a father has done something good, Hashem remembers it and does good for the child also. a grandfather does something good, Hashem remembers it and does good for the grandchild also. That's the way it goes. That's the way it's usually understood. Of course there's something in that, but that is not the basis of Schus Ovis. The basis of Schus Ovis is something quite different. I wonder if we could close that with those. I'm hoping it won't get too hot with the door open. Now the basis of Schus Ovis is really, if you want to understand it more deeply, Pshat is Hashem, what the Father does in you, which is remembered, goes really considerably further. It's so difficult to know the motivation in a person. If one takes any deed that a person does, it passes through several stages. First, there is the Hebrew Yet, and that is, comes into the mind. Comes into the mind. The next stage is, it's felt by the heart. Felt by the heart. The mind understands it, controls it, and it's felt by the heart. And I must warn you at this particular stage that we've got to be very careful when we speak about the mind. Because the mind can have false thoughts. What is the great difference today between the existentialist and the religious person? The existentialist, you've got to start with the mind and also from something. The existentialist starts from what he is immediately experiencing. He sees in the world pain, suffering. Says there is no meaning. It's all absurd. No meaning. It's all absurd. That's his starting. What's about his heart? Heart feels the same way. All absurd. He gives expression to it. His mouth utters the words. He articulates how absurd it is. And his deeds and his actions are geared to all that. And from that you've got existentialism, permissiveness, and everything that goes with it. What many of the existentialists don't know is that it wasn't mind and heart, but it was heart and mind. What man doesn't want to have a good time? Of course he wants to have a good time. That is the dictate of his heart. Every person, every man, doesn't want to be troubled by his conscience. So his heart molds his mind. What he wants to do, I'm speaking about the heart as the seat of desire, as opposed to the seat of intellectual objectivity. The heart desires. Well, so what he does is, then, the thinking fits into the mold of what he desires. We call it rationalization sometimes. What is rationalization? This is what I want to do. Now, that's not the Torah way. The Torah way is first the Moach, first the mind. And the mind has got to be very careful. And then you let it seep through into the heart. But it's first got to be in the mind. The existentialist starts the wrong way round. But even the Torah way, when we say it's the mind, it doesn't start there. because it's very difficult to know what triggers it all off. What starts it? Is it the mind that starts it, or is it the heart that seeps through to the mind and there sets the whole thing into motion? Very difficult to know. So we want, first of all, we want the Torah to set it into motion. And that was apropos of the shiur that I gave you last week on these four, the Peshat and the Remes, especially the Remes of these four. Why the Torah is so important? The study of the Torah is not because we must know the law so that we can carry it out. A lot of the Torah, the knowledge of it doesn't help us at all. But the mere act of learning is an avodah. That improves the whole person. That disciplines, it improves the whole person. It gives him a Torah outlook onto everything. And it's that Torah outlook that his mind must fit into. Am I making myself clear? Now, so the Torah person has got the Torah. What happens if the Torah person has got an idea? It doesn't go straight to the heart. There is a verse in the book of Proverbs. Unless you know the book of Proverbs by heart, Ein chochmo ve'ein tmino ve'ein eitzor le'neged Hashem. There is no wisdom or understanding or counsel in the face of Hashem. That means when it is against anything that Hashem says. So, what it means is, the Gemara gives very extreme examples of this. If the deen is, this is, the Torah says, this is what one has to do, and this is the way one has to behave. And the person says, that's illogical. Business is that illogical. What do we do? Man says that it's illogical. You know, today it's all very much easier and for a very good reason. Hashem works with us through the attribute of mercy. And it's made it very much easier. When I was a boy and I was finishing school, Shabbos was a terrible problem. It was a terrible problem. And in South Africa and England, it was easier than it was on the continent. In the continent, in high schools, children had to go to school on Shabbos by government law, 6 days a week. In England and in the colonies and in the dominions, those days they were hardly in the dominions, it was colonies. 5 days, as in America, 5 days. But immediately one left school, whatever one went into, was a question of Shabbos. And those were days, very difficult times. Times of the Depression, very difficult times. If you took medicine, then you could get into medical school in those days, lectures on Shabbos. If you took law, lectures on Shabbos, Friday night especially. If you took accountancy, lectures on Shabbos. That is, if you could go afford to go to university. If you became an apprentice to a chemist, to a pharmacist, had to work on Shabbos. If you went into a business, had to work on Shabbos. So, this was a very great nisoya. Were only a few boys that under those circumstances will not work on Shabbos. Now, there was one boy who was in my class, and this boy had a wonderful brain. And he was a specialist at Latin and Greek. He could lead Latin and Greek. And we were taught to work out Latin and Greek. He could lead Latin and Greek. He went into a shoe store, a business. It was a wholesale business, and he made an arrangement that he gets rid of Shabbos. Couldn't do anything else. And when I went back to South Africa, I wanted to know about him. He had done very well, but that's he wasn't happy. That's not what he wanted to do. But he made the best of it. He carried on. He'd done extremely well. He was good in business. He'd done extremely well. Wasn't prepared now. Everybody else said, but this is mad. This is mad. This is not the way. You don't do a thing like this. You don't sacrifice your whole life for this. That's not what religion is for. And we know the same. Religion was made for man, not man for religion, but it's wrong. And that is what Shlomo HaMelech says, Ein chochmo ve'ein yino ve'ein eitzor neged Hashem. Hashem says that, then there's just nothing about it. Hashem says you just eat kosher. If I wouldn't believe that it's from Hashem, I wouldn't eat kosher. I'm not mad. But I've got to worry about getting my beef from Los Angeles, and if I take the trouble to go and see everything, how it's done, and how it's slaughtered, and how it's prepared, I want to see everything. And if I go on holiday, we take with everything with us, and schlep everything with us. You think I'd do it if it wasn't, if I didn't believe that this was direct on my chair? But ein chokmo, but ein tzuno, but ein eitzor neged Hashem. There's just no question about that. That's all there is. I would never do it if it wasn't like that. If I didn't believe in Torah and Hashem, I wouldn't keep these things. I'm not mad. You think I'm superstitious? I'd never do a thing like that. Because I believe that this is Torah and Hashem. That is why I do it. Right, so there is no chokmo, but ein tzuno neged Hashem. So when it starts according to the Torah, anything that I want to do starts in the mind, and it is tested out with the Torah, and if it bears the test, it seeps through to the heart. Once it seeps through to the heart, then you've got the combination of the heart and the intellect, which is the combination of intellect and desire, and then comes articulation. Now express it. Once I express it, and it comes from those depths, and it crosses my lips, and that is the reason why we speak of Loshon HaKodesh, and Sapat Ivrit. Ivrit, there are two words for language in Hebrew. The one is Safa, and if Hebrew is Sapat Ivrit, but Loshon HaKodesh is Loshon HaKodesh. And it's interesting, in English you've got almost that you've got tongue and language. The only thing is the word language comes originally from the word tongue. But we've made a distinction between tongue and language. The Loshon HaKodesh comes from the tongue, it comes from much deeper. The Ivrit is from the lips outwards. Only from the lips. Doesn't go deeper than the lips. When there's been mind and there's been the heart, and now I express it, as soon as I've expressed it, I've created something, and that is never lost. Something goes onto a tape recorder. Something goes onto a record. It is there. But this record is far more effective. Far more effective. This is, it's always there to such an extent that had we the machinery today, we could retrieve what he said. And you know what they, for many, many years now, they've got these huge antenna, and they're trying to pick up communications from space, thinking the other worlds, they might be able to pick up something. And what they want to hear is some kind of 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, something, a rhythm or something, that they'll be able to connect this, that this isn't just chance, this isn't just some noise there, but this is something that is emitted for us to receive. What they have discovered is one thing. There is a certain noise that they've picked up. That they feel is the Big Bang from the creation of the world. So now the scientists think that this noise that they hear is that sounds like this noise. So they are retrieving that noise. It will never be lost. They are retrieving that sound. And that is the only way that you're able to explain itself. That sound they retrieve. So anything, the Aseres Abibros, with the Ten Commandments, with Vilna Mount Sinai, those sounds are there. They're always there. Nothing gets lost. From there, once there is the articulation, the next step is deed and action. Now that is the way it goes. That is the process that it all makes. When deed and action goes through all that process, that is never lost. When Avraham, Yitzchok, and Yaakov did all they did, and they came with Moshe, all that he did, and those are our forebears. Everything that they did, that is never lost, is never lost. One believer. Now I want to tell you something else. When we speak about a person who is so complex, you know, he's a man in Paris who's Jewish, and he's a master of mind. Marcel, he's a master of mind. I once went to an evening, which was only Marcel, that was the only thing that was on the screen. I found it rather tiring, because not a word was uttered. Not a word. All that was is he was different. It was just too wonderful. He didn't have to say anything. Everything was done by mind. He walked down the windy street, but you could see the wind. And he was walking. He portrayed it so well. I was discussing it with somebody once. What goes into that? Into bringing about those expressions, the tendons, the muscles, the nerves, and the cells. I discussed it also with a microbiologist. What would he say the number of cells that are brought into play in order to bring about a facial expression? Now, don't forget, what Marcel Marceau does are simulated facial expressions. They're not real. Now, a real expression which expresses the whole feeling that one has, and you can see it in the eyes and you can see it on the face. What if you take the tendons, the muscles, the nerves, and then the cells? You know what is estimated today, how many cells there are in the human body? You don't know. Yes, 3 trillion. 3 trillion. That's what is estimated to date. So they've got a tremendous knowledge to themselves. So it's estimated that there are 3 trillion. And a trillion is 1 million squared. 1 million million is a trillion. And this is 3 million million years. That is one prophecy. I have explained to you that the source of that is from Hashem. And if we are able to trace ourselves back to our sources, and it's still our sources that are at work, we couldn't exist if it were not through the source, then everything we have in the human body has its spiritual equivalent in the soul. But there are souls and souls and souls. We are speaking about the soul that we are working with. But that soul has got a soul, and that soul has got a soul. And it goes in the thousands till it comes to its right back to its very origin. And everything we do affects it right back to its origin. And then it goes back to us, comes back again to us. Now, can you imagine how complex the soul is? 3 trillion cells. There's the equivalent of that. I spoke to this in a facial expression. How many cells can go into it? He said, I wouldn't be surprised if 1/4 of the total number of cells. That's 1/4 of 3 trillion. The number of zero and 30. Can one see how complex a person is? And we decide a person, impure motives, hasn't done right, he was wrong, he did it for the impure motive, he did good, we sit in judgment over it. Do we know how many factors there are? It's not merely a factor of hereditary and environment. Look at all the other factors there. And the genes come into the cells, all this. Just look at all the factors there are that go into it. Who knows? And what one has inherited. And the effect the environment has on our minds, and from our minds into the cells, and from the cells into their origin. How complex the human being is. Now, when a person, this is what we inherit from our ancestors. Nothing is ever lost. And the next point I have to stop. You know, things change hands by what we call the key. If I buy something from somebody, I make it king. It's a contract. And through the contract, it passes immediately. If a person says to you, I'm giving you as a present my home in Bel Air or in Malibu, and a year later you come to him and he says, you know, I want my home in Malibu or in Bel Air, he says, what home? He said, you promised me. He said, I've changed my mind. You can't do anything. You can't do anything. But if there is a deed of sale, then you can't do anything. There could be a deed of sale. A gift, same thing. There's got to be some kind of a deed, otherwise it doesn't happen. It's got to pass over into my possession. There is one thing that doesn't apply, and that is to the death. That works altogether differently. The idea of schus always is that it is an inheritance. It becomes ours. And from that that I've got to take it. So you can see the good that it becomes ours, and the bad comes ours. Now, what we have got to discuss is, how can one be certain that the good becomes ours and we don't lose it? And how we can avoid the bad becoming ours, and it shouldn't become ours, we don't want it. What happens then? How can one avoid it? That we've got to say. Yehoram took the bad. It was a lot of bad. Omri takes it. Achol, Omri, Izebel, Yehoram gets it there. No question about it. We have examples where they have oil taking the bad. So how difficult it is for day one. But that is an inheritance. In the same way, a father has a fortune and he dies, it goes over to the child. The child hasn't got anything about it. It's his. Immediately the father dies, it's his. He's the master of it all. That is the way Scrooge Father comes. Now that is the business of Skus Ovis. Short of Skus Ovis is Father does good for you. All right, you've been very patient. I'm sorry I didn't give you a break, but it's just this that I wanted to get. Once I did this year with you last week, then you.